welcome to the Deep Sea Podcast, a punk take on a science podcast about everything deep sea. I'm Dr. Tom Lindley. With me is the Professor Alan Jameson from way out mid-Pacific. Is that where you are?
Yes, very much so. In the middle of nowhere, studying a place that no one's ever heard of.
Looked outside, nothing. Nothing but ocean.
Yeah, it's just a weird, wet, blue, sloppy mass of water outside. It's got bumps in it. Could be anywhere in the world, really.
Well, I really enjoyed your comment a couple of episodes back saying that you could tell the ocean by the colour.
Yeah.
And it hadn't clocked to me until you said that. It was like, damn, he's right.
Yeah, you can, yeah.
So it's discernibly Pacific out there, but you couldn't go further than that.
It is definitely Pacific out there. We're actually only 60 miles off the equator, about 4 days north of Samoa, in round about the edge of the EEZ of Kiribati. If anyone knows where any of these places are, or studying a place called the Nova Canton Trough.
That's hard to find. I had a little look for that, and there's not much on that.
There's never been a paper published on it, as far as I know. No one's ever taken a sample or a photograph from the entire... It's actually a fracture zone, but it's 8,000 meters deep and 400 miles long. So it's enormous, but it's sitting right in the middle of nowhere. And yeah, and so we've done probably about 50 landers already and about 6 subdives, mapped almost the whole thing.
And how long have you been out there? You're saying about 6 weeks in, is it now?
Must be close to 6 weeks now, but we've still got a couple of weeks to go yet. And then it will hand over and other people will come out for another 6 weeks. So it's a 3-month expedition.
Not much downtime on this boat, just straight into the next.
No, I know when I get off here, I've got 3 weeks off and then back on for a month and then 3 weeks off and back on for 2 months and so on and so on.
I thought you were trying to phase this down. I thought you were trying to get a sea less. This is intense.
I practically live here now. So then I've got 2.5 months in Antarctica over Christmas. So, but after that, the idea is that I'm trying to train people up so I can go and live the good life. But yeah, no, that's good. It's very good.
Antarctica's a good send off. Seems to be the place to be. It's going to be busy this season. There seems to be a lot of folk going.
It always is. It's incredible how many ships are in Antarctica over that season. Every nation probably sends a research vessel down there. And I was talking to member Rob McCallum, who was on the Don Walsh episode, and he's got expeditions going down there like a lot, like in double figures every year. It's quite a busy place.
It is popular. Doing that Everest thing, doing that sort of queues of ships to go to Antarctica.
Yeah. Well, Antarctica's a big place.
Yeah, yeah, we can spread out. We don't fight over the sun loungers.
Yeah, we can do a deep Antarctic episode when we're there.
Yes, we should actually. We might be able to wave from adjoining vessels.
Yeah, no, it's all going good. I've done a subdive to 6,200, 6,800. Did two that had to get cancelled on the way down. And then the other guys did the 8,000 meter dive. And then I did a dive to 3,200 and then another one to 3,800. Day after tomorrow, I will dive to 7,200. And then someone else will do a 5,000 meter dive. And then we're done for this leg.
What's your tally now?
21 dives, I think.
In total? It feels more.
Yeah, we've had quite a lot that haven't quite got to the bottom. I've had to come back up. So I think I've got in and out of it about 30 times, 35 times or something like that. But it's 21. We've seen all sorts of cool stuff. We were chasing fish the other day.
Yeah.
We're chasing there. Not chasing them. They were there and they felt like they were being chased. But yeah, came across some lizard fish, spider fish, a couple of rat tails. The hermit crabs are really funny. It's been a while since I've been as shallow as 3,800, but there's all these little hermit crabs, you know, the ones with the urchins that grow on their back.
Yeah, and make more shell for them so they don't have to leave.
Yeah, and they're just dragging these things around, and so they scuttle around, and then one of them just kind of stopped in front of us and turned around and was kind of like, do you want a piece of me? And we're sitting there going, okay, if you want to play this game. I just love crabs, are so aggressive.
Yeah.
Really funny. Yeah, lots of cool stuff. The dive we did the other day to 3,200 had old whale pits everywhere. Absolutely everywhere, completely strong with what we think are whale pits.
Oh, the little troughs, the little snufflers.
Yeah, everywhere. 3,800, there wasn't a single one, but 3,200, they were really quite conspicuous. In fact, I would say that at no time could you not see one with that many.
That's really weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, maybe one day we'll get to the bottom of one of those. Maybe we'll catch a whale in the act.
Yeah, one day.
Before we dive properly in, wanted to say a quick thank you to all of our patrons for continuing to support us and to help making the show happen. So the new patrons we'd like to thank for this month is Martin Vandermeer and Sean Thompson. Sean, I'm in the lab. I'm behind you. Sorry, Sean actually works at Te Papa, and I charged through his lab slamming doors on the way to the photography suite. So I'm sure I'm loathed, but yeah, now I'm in stereo. Yeah, so thank you for supporting the show. We've had some good stuff going on Discord. We've got Jeff in there now as a nexus of social media and connecting people, and posting lots of cool stuff from his networks. And a little bit of science happened because someone Jeff is aware of, an ROV pilot who posts some of his videos onto Reddit and things like that, got some really nice footage of an anglerfish that has not actually been recorded live before. And she's got four little males attached to her. And I don't think there's a record of ones with males on it. And we were able to put that ROV pilot in touch with the expert who wants to write up that as an observation paper. And so, yeah, science happening in the Discord live. And there's a nice little community there as well. Lots of people helping each other out. Lots of people, could you read over this? And I want to get into this. And of course, importantly, deep sea memes. So, thank you to everyone, and thank you for building that community. We don't always have a lot of time to jump in ourselves, but there's this nice collection of like-minded people who are just kind and generous and having deep sea fun over there. So thank you to everyone. Oh, I had an observation about New Zealand, which was totally not deep sea related.
What's that then?
It's kind of hidden in plain sight. And I know both me and you sort of value this as a resource. There aren't enough Daves. I know Daves, that there are Daves here, but there aren't enough Daves for everyone to have a My Mate Dave. They're actually quite thin on the ground here.
I think that is actually a common problem. I wrote a whole article on Daves.
There's the extinction, isn't there?
There is. I'm looking at it now. I've written 1,400 words on Daves and why. I've got a graph of total number of Daves born between 1880 and 2020. And if you extrapolate the downward trend, no one will be christened Dave by 2035.
This is the mass extinction we need to be talking about.
Its peak was 1955 to 1960. Oh, was
the glory.
Easily the most number of Daves. And it was up to 80,000 Daves in the UK.
What a golden age.
Yeah.
We talk about when the North Sea was full of cod, but remember when the streets were full of Daves?
Exactly.
I had to leave my Dave behind. I've left my Dave in the UK.
Well, he's still free. He's not in prison, is he? He's still free to come in.
No, but I just, you know, I tried to rehome him, but I hope he's all right. Yeah. There are Daves here, and I've got a Dave in my sights, if I'm honest, but there's not enough of them to go around.
Yeah. I mean, I don't get how you could grow up in the UK without a mate Dave. I mean, how do you blame stuff that you actually did, but you just say, oh, it was David did it?
Who eggs you on?
Yeah. Who buys you your first beer and all that kind of stuff, you know? And you can't just go, oh, my mate Jackson with an X. You know, it just doesn't sound right. It's, you need your mate Dave to get you out of trouble.
It's true. Oh, so a salute to Daves.
Yeah.
We should start a breeding program or something.
Anyway, we're diverging. We're going off on a tangent here.
Very diverging. So I'm back. You know, thanks for holding the fort while I was away at sea. I really enjoyed the episode. I think we should do something with that deep sea rant. I think that was very, very good.
I can't remember that episode. It feels like a year ago.
Time has been weird. It's been weird.
I can't remember what it was about. What was it about? That was the Jeff D one.
Yes. And you did a really good rant on sort of what we consider the deep sea and how arbitrary or sort of flexible those dimensions are.
Yeah.
Right the way to it not being deep at all, but people just considering it open ocean.
I have actually written that. That was an article that I've been writing, thinking I was going to put that as an opinion piece to try and get a deep sea move to 1,000 meters. But I just haven't quite got the time to finish it. But that was the gist of it. Hopefully I'll publish it one day.
Yeah. Yeah, you should. There was obviously a lot of research went into that.
A couple of people have actually written to us and asked if it's published or is there a transcript of it and stuff. So maybe that'll be the motivation to actually finish that thing. It's just one of those little side rants you've always got on the go, you know?
Yeah.
Everyone needs to have a little side rant in their back pocket.
Yeah, yeah, that should go somewhere. I mean, you could technically cite the podcast, but don't set precedent on that.
Oh, jeez. No. We are not a citable reference.
We're certainly not peer-reviewed. I suppose we are reviewed.
Yeah.
2 stars.
For example, when talking about bioluminescence, it's the mix of luciferin, luciferase that oxidizes, and when it's ejected from the animal, it might make a little farty noise.
Yeah.
Reference podcast 2020.
I stand by that. It should make a little farty noise. It's more likely to do a farty noise than an electric tinkly noise.
I guess it's more likely to make a little farty noise than not.
Yeah, being ejected from a sphincter often. So I'm back from only 3 weeks at sea, not the huge stint that you had, but lovely time on the Tangaroa. That's a lovely vessel. I've not been on that one before, but it's good and cozy. It's very capable.
They have very good breakfast sausages.
They've got very good food in general. Food was really good on this one. And there was an infinite ice cream fridge, which was dangerous. But yeah, it was tough though. It was tough. There was a lot of work going on there. And I've not really taken any time off to recover yet. So I'm still feeling the offshoreness because we went straight into the workshop afterwards, which was really nice. So it brought over a load of international taxonomists and experts in their groups, and everyone sort of mucked in and did the sorting and worked on their particular groups. But it was a nice sort of social atmosphere, nice networking, got to know a lot of people.
How many new species?
Oh, well, the magic number, of course, of 100.
On the nose.
Yeah, exactly.
That's funny, that, because we had another trip that ultimately you and I did not go on, but I sent some guys on it, on the Falkor 2 to Nazca Ridge, and they also found 100 new species on the nose.
Well, you stop when you get there. You stop when you get to 100.
Right.
You're just like, that. Yeah, that's enough. That's to fill the remit.
Yeah.
You've got to leave some behind for someone else. You can't just...
Yeah, just throw them back in the water for the next crowd. So you take your first 100 and that's it. Yeah.
Well, you know, you there's the science quota. You know, it's like overfishing. You don't want to take everything so the next person can't.
And so their 100 new species and your 100 new species are getting mixed up in the media.
Yes, yeah, because the headline is really, really similar. And it was happening at the same time, which is why I couldn't go on it.
Just for fun, because we're going to be finished here in like, oh, I don't know. Actually, I don't know anymore. When we finish this leg, I'll put out a press release to say that I found 100 new species too, and we can see how much we can mix up three different expeditions.
They just get all blended in the in the public consciousness.
Yeah, well, I'll just have a set piece, 100 new species. Oh. Deep sea, extraordinary animals, never been seen before. Spooky.
There were some lovely visuals. There's very cool coffin fish, bright orange looking thing. Mm. Looks like a Pokemon. That was sort of the poster child for it. I think that was one of the contenders for new. We certainly know of a few in the area. Andrew has a cool common name he's trying to push for those, which is the Frankenstein coffin fish, because they look like they're stitched together. Those Ooh. Really deep pores in the head look like stitching. So I quite like his name for that.
Do you know what I found at the bottom of the sea last week?
Go on. That's a great sentence. What did you find at the bottom of the sea last week, Alan?
A packet of Chinese cigarettes.
Whoa. All right.
Yeah, there you go. We couldn't bring them back, but it's the weird things you find sometimes.
I mean, there were worse things to find, but there's probably better ones as well.
Yeah. I thought it was something really exciting. I'm like, oh, look at the deep red color there. I'm like, oh, that's got a real bit of structure to it. And you get there and you're like, ah.
Litter.
Yeah. Nice.
Well done, folks. I had a nice little sort of listener interaction. So Ken Stowe, who we've actually interacted with a few times, is an active member of the community. It turns out he was second engineer on the Sea Education Association's Education Brigadine. So a lovely sailing ship. And he was coming into Wellington. And just on an off chance, he said, do you want to hang out when we get there? So yeah, that's it, actually. You can just email me if you're turning up in Wellington and I'll come say hi. And it went really nicely. So we gave them a tour of the museum and the collections, and they gave us a tour of their vessel, which is beautiful, traditional sailing vessel. And they do some marine science off it as well. So the students live on there for sort of 6 weeks, 2 months, and yeah, get to sail a vessel, learn about life at sea, and also do some sampling and do their own science projects. So I'm hoping that will be the start of a nice little collaboration, because if they're popping in every year, we can say hi, we can help them ID some myctophids. They get a lot of lanternfish, and we know there's some unaccounted for ones out there, so it'd be cool if we could work together. And it was really nice to hang out with Ken.
Yeah, but given the recent movie phenomena, when you're describing that story of you hanging out with Ken, I've got a very different Ken in my head.
Ah,
yeah. Is he like Ken from Barbie, or is he?
He's not. No.
Oh, okay, that's a shame.
Well, he can be in your head.
Yeah, okay. Tom's big day out with Ken.
He's got a good posture considering the size of the engine room he has to work in. We'll maybe put some pictures if they're okay with that, but we all crammed in there and felt sympathy for him when he's out at sea, because I know they were worried about the weather, because of course as a sailing vessel, they're sort of more vulnerable to it and they have to work along with it. And yeah, as you know, Wellington can be windy. And so they were I think they were leaving at about 5 a.m. in the morning to try and dodge some bad weather. So we checked in with them just to make sure that they got out okay and got round the headland and into safety.
Is it not more like Wellington is sometimes not windy rather than sometimes can be windy?
Yes.
Yeah, that would be the time.
That would be the norm. I like that it embraces it though, with like wind art sculptures, and the Wellington sign has some of the letters blowing away and things like that. It's quite cute, but it is howling outside right now. Speaking of friends of the show and things going on, Moku Art Studio are gearing up for their virtual exhibition. I think by the time this episode comes out, unfortunately, the entries will be closed, but we're really excited to see the artwork that comes out of this. So nice collaboration between sort of science communication and good old lovely art. And there is quite a broad suite of judges, which includes me and you, Alan. So we are part of the judging panel, along with some impressive artists.
I look forward to that.
Yeah, some cool artists on there as well. There's a couple of prominent science communicators as well, Helen Scales and Sarah McAttack, who does Skype a Scientist. And also I recognize the sculptor who does those submerged sculptures and then lets coral grow all over them.
Yeah, I hung out with him in Monaco.
Oh, I'd never met him before. That's quite cool.
Yeah, it's quite impressive what he does.
Yeah, my mum randomly sent me that as a link recently because she found it and really liked those. And then I could respond with like, oh, I'm a fellow judge with that person. And I think we've just both had a moment of like, your life's gone in a weird way. It's all good, but I could have never planned this.
I look forward to that.
Yeah, I think that would be good fun. So for this episode, we are going to focus on one particular critter. It was actually a listener request. Actually, Ken was one of the people who requested this. So people wanted a special episode on hagfish just because they are so weird and wacky. And I feel like people are aware of them, but they're maybe not as aware of just how unusual the hagfish are and what they sort of represent for, say, studying evolution and how fish have developed. We have had some firsthand interactions with hagfish, and they're always delightful. Never regret finding a hagfish. The one jumps out to me, Alan, but I think maybe it's your story to tell. You're on the front line.
Is this the one with our favorite geologist?
Yeah, when hagfish go where you don't expect to find a hagfish.
Yeah, so there's a particular hagfish that works its way into an amphipod trap from, must have been a rock hole, Hand Basin, somewhere like that. I guess it was relatively early on, and I was working with Heather Stewart as a geologist, so she was doing the cores and we were doing the smelly stuff, and I invited her over to see what's in the trap. And opened the trap, and the hagfish fell out, and she physically jumped about 3 feet in the air, and we got it on GoPro. So we made some funny videos of her meeting a hagfish for the first time, shall we say. And we'd slow it right down. It was really funny.
It's a good vertical jump, though. You know, she's a...
Oh, yeah.
She's strong.
It was like a young gazelle.
Yeah.
Young gazelle trying to jump over a fence. It was that kind of jump.
And it had the sort of feel of those joke packets of peanuts where all the snakes leap out. It did.
Yeah.
It did a pretty good job of making an entrance.
Yeah, like a proper jack-in-the-box. Yeah. Only it's a hagfish trying to slime everything. So yeah, they're really hard to work with, but I find them fascinating. I wouldn't say I'm particularly fond of the hagfish. I kind of perhaps got a different type of respect for it. But yeah, they're funny old things.
They are.
They're really hard to dissect as well. Super hard.
They blunt your scalpel blade almost immediately.
Yeah.
They've got this lattice of collagen through the skin, and the skin is actually quite loose, so it kind of moves with the blade. Yeah, they are difficult to work with, but you can sort of appreciate their strange morphology. And I know we got some videos, and there's some other famous videos out there of the slime defense in action. They're famous for producing huge quantities of slime when they're upset, but actually seeing it in situ and in the wild is a fairly recent recording. I think Vincent Zinsen's work out of New Zealand was the first where a small shark bites into one and gets a mouthful of slime. And we got a few during our time. And I think you've got some more recently as well, haven't you?
One of the early Five Deeps trips, I think in the shallow end of Puerto Rico, we filmed that. A shark came along and bit one, and it just slammed it straight into its mouth. And the shark just looked like it was physically disgusted. And backed off and spat the hagfish out. It's just like, wow, there you go, job done. But it's interesting because the other fish and the sharks obviously hate this stuff. And by the end of the dive, the land is like covered in slime. But the giant isopods don't care.
That's interesting.
Whatever it is it puts off the sharks, the giant isopods and the amphipods for that matter, just don't really care at all. They're just climbing through it. So they must have a different or more resilience to it or something like that. But one of my favorite hagfish stories is a university I used to work for that remained nameless with a student. Who will remain nameless. She was doing a hagfish project and we caught like a couple hundred for her. And I think she was just sexing and staging them or something like that. It was some population dynamic thing. And they're kind of difficult to dissect and they're very difficult to sex. So we gave her a handful and said, just practice on these ones. And they were dead. And then she turned up at the lab and she said, right, do you know what you're doing? And she goes, yeah, I've got a diagram of the anatomy on the wall. And started looking at this diagram going, a hagfish, you say? She goes, yeah, I printed it off this morning and there it is there. So I'll just follow that as a key to where all the bits are. I'm like, that's an earthworm.
It's a tube, isn't it?
It's a brown tube.
Food goes in one end, poop comes out the other.
Yeah, it was an earthworm. Maybe I shouldn't have said anything, just let her do it. And just maybe she thought she had a new species because its internal anatomy was not the same as an earthworm. It's one of those moments you're like, all right, don't laugh. Just let's talk this through. This is not even a fish.
It's not even aquatic.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Oops.
That's how we learn. We have all these anecdotal stories and the little bits that we've seen here and there, but shall we go directly to the source? Shall we go directly to the expert on hagfish?
No.
No? Okay. Oh, never mind. I'll just go to someone else then.
Yeah, it's got a frog expert or someone who studies earthworms.
Yes. Okay, no, yeah, we'll go straight to the earthworm expert.
No, no, there's one more hagfish story that my guys, Todd, etc., they were out at Christmas Island a couple of months ago and they pulled up hagfish from over 3,000 metres, which is pretty cool. Those big ones, big Goliath ones.
You got a Goliath? Oh, yes, yes, you did share that picture with us. Yeah.
Yeah, because you and Andrew are going to have to come and sort them out for us.
We would gladly sort them out for you.
I forgot about those, yeah. That was a big find from last year, yeah.
Yeah, I've forgotten about that too, because we had lots of chat about how to preserve them, because...
You were talking about you had to brush their teeth.
You do. I know that sounds strange, but that slime, once you fix it, like sets like cement, and it just makes them so difficult to work with. So yeah, when you're preserving a hagfish, you've got to avert their weird toothy mouths, and you've got to give them a little toothbrush, because you can. You need to see the shape of the teeth to ID some of them. And the other one is to give them a good shave to remove all of that slime. So you can use the sort of edge of a knife to scrape all that slime off, because you need to count slime pores. Wonderful creatures.
Nice.
Oh, we're excited for that. Yeah, give us a shout for that.
Yeah. All right, well, maybe we should get an expert on that.
Yeah, we are going to talk to Douglas Fudge, a professor of marine biology at Chapman University in California. His research aims to understand the biophysics and processes of marine animals, such as predator defense, feeding, and locomotion. His current projects aim to understand predator-prey interactions between hagfish and sharks, and the function of hagfish slime and how the slime can be used in biomimic applications. So let's have a chat. Thanks so much for coming on and having a chat with us.
Oh, so great to be here, Tom. Thanks for inviting me.
So we've touched on hagfish quite a lot in the past. They've turned up in a few of our other stories, but we haven't really had a chance to let them breathe and focus on them a bit more thoroughly. So let's start at the beginning. Could you explain what hagfish are and where we find them?
Yeah, so hagfish are a group of deep sea animals. And I know the term deep sea is a little bit controversial and you guys have opinions about that, but you know, these are animals that are found on the bottom of the ocean in most of the oceans of the world. We don't tend to find them in the Arctic and the Antarctic, but pretty much everywhere else we find them. They're sort of eel-like in their morphology, but that's really the only resemblance to eel. So they're long and skinny like an eel, but they are not teleost fish like eels. They don't have fins, they don't have gills, they don't have jaws. So, you know, they look almost more like a worm than an eel when you get up close to it. In terms of their ecology, they are scavengers. So many of the listeners might have seen images or videos of hagfishes swarming around a dead whale. So when something dead falls to the bottom of the ocean, it's usually a hagfish that gets there first. So they're really good at the scavenging lifestyle. In terms of diversity, right now, there's about 90 species that are described, and that number increases by one or two every year as we explore more of the deep sea.
And what are they doing when they're not scavenging? We obviously see them gather at our baited landers and at whale falls and things like that. Are they living in burrows? Are they hiding away somewhere?
Yeah, that's a good question. So burrowing is something that we're very interested in, and it seems to be an important part of the hagfish lifestyle. We don't know how important it is. It seems that some species spend a lot of time in burrows and then other ones less so. But what is clear is that they have a very low energy lifestyle. So their strategy seems to be use as little energy as possible and wait until something delicious falls to the ocean floor and then be one of the first ones to get there. And then they have some other strategies for sort of defending food that they find as well. And we can talk about that when we talk more about slime.
There may be some listeners who are struggling to visualize a hagfish. So it's about a foot long to a couple of feet long, maybe long, slender eel-like thing. There's a single nostril usually at the very snout end. And some, what's the technical term for those whiskers almost?
Barbels is the technical term for those. Yeah. And there's six of those sort of sticking out from the face. And as you said, there's a giant single nostril on the front of the face. And that's the sort of water intake for their gills. They have multiple gill pouches and those are sort of further back on the body. And then there's these little holes called gill apertures where the water exits the body after irrigating the gills.
And there's one mysterious one, isn't there? it has a separate name. There's one of those outlets is larger than the others. Do we know why yet?
Yes. So this is interesting. So there's a little tube called the pharyngocutaneous duct, and that connects the pharynx with the last gill aperture. Okay, so, you know, let's say we're talking about a given species of hagfish that has six gill pouches. That hagfish might have six gill apertures on each side, but on the left side, the last gill aperture might be a little bit bigger because that extra duct fuses with that last gill aperture. And so the gill apertures look a little bit asymmetrical on the left side and the right side. Now, where it gets a little complicated is one of the genera, Myxini, which is the second largest genus of hagfishes, has multiple gill pouches, but only a single gill aperture on each side. And we don't really understand why that is. For some reason, they've sort of gotten rid of individual gill apertures, and they have a single aperture close to that final, most posterior gill. And in those species, the left side opening is much bigger than on the right side because of that pharyngocutaneous duct that fuses with it.
And do we know what the duct is for? Is it for clearing larger material from the gills? Or
I don't fully understand what it's for. Somebody might, but I have thought about it and I don't fully understand it, because they do seem to be able to reverse flow and sort of cough out their nostril. And they'll do this if they get slime in their face. So I don't fully understand what that duct is there for.
Yeah, there's something going on. It seems so deliberate, but yeah, maybe we've not fully gotten to the bottom of it.
Yeah, I'm totally fascinated with the gill anatomy question. And one of the species we have in the lab has 11 or to 12 gills and gill apertures. And then another one from the Atlantic is from Myxini, has, I think it's six gills and then a single aperture. There's interesting patterns in different clades of how the gill apertures are arranged. And some of them, they're sort of clustered together, almost like they're in the process evolutionarily of fusing together, but they haven't quite. There's one group that used to be in the genus Quadratus, which doesn't exist anymore, but it was called Quadratus because there were four gill apertures in a square instead of a line. You know, what are the selective pressures that are pushing around these gill apertures?
This is huge variation.
I would love to know. Yeah, I think it might have something to do with burrowing, but I have yet to come up with a really coherent hypothesis that explains all the variation.
Very cool. You can sort of see a shadow of eyes, that there's light receptive patches where we'd usually associate eyes.
Yeah, again, this depends on the species, but the Pacific hagfish that we have in our tanks in my lab, they look like they have an eye spot, and it's, you know, it's almost like an orca, like it's too big to be an eye. And then what you realize is that it's a transparent window in the skin, and the actual eye is in the middle of that transparent window below it. So very strange kind of situation, an eye totally covered with skin. Maybe not that surprising for an animal that burrows a lot.
Yeah, and pushes into flesh as well.
Yeah, but then the Atlantic hagfish, they don't have a transparent window. They still have this sort of, you know, vestigial eye. If you dissect the skin away from the head, there it is. But there's no transparent window. There's just like, there's skin, there's layers of muscle. There's just no way there's light coming through in a way that would allow them to form any kind of image in those species.
Is the same true of the juveniles? We see that in some of the cusk eels. They use their eyes less and less as they get bigger. And they kind of skin over.
Oh, that's interesting. I'm not sure about that. I've never noticed in the really little ones that they have a transparent window. That's a really good thing to look for. But I'm pretty sure it's the same in the little ones.
Yeah.
There is one species that we just described it a few years ago. This is a new species from the Galapagos, and it's a completely albino hagfish. And so we gave it the name the ghost hagfish because it just looks very strange, and it's white, has zero pigment in its skin. And in the young ones, they're basically transparent. The skin is completely transparent. You can see the slime glands, you can see the heart beating, you can see the blood going through the gills. So that's a kind of interesting thing. It's not a transparent window. It's just the entire skin is transparent.
Yeah. And the ancestral state seems to have eyes. There was some fossils found recently where it looks like they used to have more well-developed eyes. And then this is actually a more modern state.
Yeah, I think that is becoming clear that they probably had pretty decent eyes if you go back far enough. And it was probably this adoption of a burrowing lifestyle that led them to start losing the eyes. But I should say that they are light sensitive. So, you know, even the ones that have this thick skin over the eyes, and they're clearly light sensitive. So when we open our tanks, you know, they respond to the light. So what's going on there? Like, do they have photoreceptors in the skin? That's my guess, but not much is known about that.
Cool. And I suppose the elephant in the room, the one of the things they're famous for, if we're talking sort of gross anatomy, is being Nathan, basically, but not having a jaw, not having a true jaw. So they have a very interesting apparatus at the business end. Could you tell us a little bit about sort of how they feed and that jawless structure?
Yeah. So, you know, the jawless name is a little bit misleading because it implies that they are really kind of simple up front. And, you know, that they were just sort of like a worm with a hole on the front or something like that. The truth is very different from that. They have an incredibly complex anatomy at the anterior end associated with feeding. And, you know, they don't have jaws in the sort of technical sense and evolutionary sense of what we think of as structures that move up and down dorsoventrally and that were derived most likely from gill arches. But they have structures that essentially function as jaws. They sort of move left to right horizontally, so not up and down like you normally think of the jaws. And a podcast is probably the worst venue for trying to describe their anatomy. So there's a couple of colleagues of mine who have done some really nice work on the anatomy of the feeding apparatus in hagfishes. So Ted Uyeno and Andrew Clark have been working on this, and it's really complicated and really fascinating. They have these horny teeth that are not true teeth. They're not bony. They're sort of keratinous in terms of the material they're made of. And they can use muscles to avert them. You've probably seen sort of scary images of hagfish on the internet with the teeth averted. And then they have this really powerful retractor muscle that can pull those teeth back in. And, you know, if it's something like a squid tentacle, it will sort of slurp it in. But they're sharp enough and powerful enough that if it's soft flesh, they can actually tear off a chunk. Mm.
And burrow into flesh as well, don't they? They tear and really get in there.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's one of the sort of amazing things that hagfishes do is they will burrow into a carcass and hang out there and sort of eat their way out, which, you know, physiologically for most animals, that would not be possible because there's no oxygen inside a rotting carcass. So that's another really cool thing about hagfishes is their ability to go without oxygen.
And are they coping without oxygen? One of my little factoids, which I want to double check is actually accurate. Can they ventilate through the anus? Is that a thing like sea turtles?
Oh, I've never heard that. Have you read that in the paper?
Oh, I got that somewhere. I need to check. I need to check because I got quoted on that at one point. So I need to find out where I got that from.
I mean, it's not impossible. Now that I think of it, so I mentioned burrowing before. We've been doing some experiments on burrowing in the lab. We finally managed to get hagfish to burrow in captivity, and we've managed to get them to do it in clear substrates. So we have a paper in review right now on hagfish burrowing in gelatin.
Oh, wow. Oh, that must look amazing.
It's amazing. And, you know, and for a long time, you know, we've known about hagfish burrowing. You know, you guys go down with your cameras and occasionally you see a hagfish driving its head into the mud. Anyway, the reason I bring this up is, you know, they make these U-shaped burrows and sometimes their tail is poking out a little bit. So I wonder if it's possible that they're doing gas exchange across their tail when they're in a burrow.
Bit of a bum snorkel.
Exactly. And one other thing I should mention about hagfish that is yet another weird thing is they have what's known as a subcutaneous sinus that is quite large. So basically their skin is not very well attached to the rest of their body. And there's all this space in between. And there's quite a bit of blood there. So it's estimated about 30% of their blood volume is in that subcutaneous sinus. And some have suggested that that blood is involved in cutaneous respiration.
Wow. Okay. And would also be a repository of oxygen as well, I'm guessing, a bit like myoglobin.
Yeah, possibly.
There's so many unusual quirks to them. I'm so glad they're still around.
I know. I mean, they've been around for a long time. If you think about the extinction events that they have survived, it's really quite remarkable.
Yes, that was one of the questions, actually, is how have they survived these events? And are they a bit like the chimera? Are they almost a prototype that used to be abundant in the shallows that have been preserved in the deep sea?
I don't know. You know, we have two hagfish fossils, so there's not a lot to go on.
It's a lot of extrapolation for a whole group.
Yeah, but you know, I can see that. I don't see any reason why they couldn't have started out in shallower water and then moved into deeper water. One of the ways that I understand their current distribution, which tends to be on the deep-ish side, so usually 100 meters and deeper, down to about 3,000 meters. And we'll talk about the slime later, I'm sure, but the slime is really effective at protecting them from fish predators, but it has zero effect on air-breathing predators.
Yeah.
So, you know, whales and seabirds that can dive that deep, pinnipeds, they just slurp up hagfish very happily and they don't mind the slime. So I think that really explains a lot about where we find hagfish, because they're essentially immune to being eaten by fish, but they're very vulnerable to marine mammals and birds. And so I think, you know, that drives them down and keeps their abundance pretty low in the upper depths.
Yeah. That makes sense. Well, I'll stop burying the lead then. Let's talk about what they're most famous for, which give them some of their common names: slime eels, snot eels. So the slime is a big factor on these guys. And they seem to use it for a multitude of different purposes. At least I've sort of observed them using it a little bit differently. Will we go in with the sort of mechanics of the slime? Because even that is incredibly complex, the little packets of threads in the mucus that goes with it. So what is the sort of structure of hagfish slime and what makes it so unique?
Yeah, so it's probably best to start with the anatomy of the glands that make it. So a typical hagfish has, let's say, 180 slime glands. Okay, so 90 slime glands on each side of its body. They tend to occur just in a line down the body. And there's really no place on a hagfish where a predator can bite without, you know, there being a nearby slime gland that is going to shoot out slime in response. So these are small-ish structures. They're, you know, a couple of millimeters in diameter. The glands are surrounded by muscle. And when that muscle contracts, it basically squeezes the contents of the gland very forcefully out into the surrounding seawater, maybe even into the predator's mouth who's biting them. And something happens when that material, we call it exudate, mixes with seawater. It expands about 10,000 times to form this remarkable material that is really good at clogging gills of fishes. So let's unpack that a little bit. So there's two components that are made within the glands. One of them is a fibrous component, and these are silk-like fibers. They're about 15 centimeters long when you sort of lay them out end to end. They're about 1 micron in diameter. So, you know, a little thinner than your typical spider silk. And it turns out their material properties are pretty similar to spider silk in many ways. In a typical volume of slime given off by a hagfish, which is about a liter, there's about 25,000 of these spider silk fibers. Now, the other component is a mucus component, and that's what gives the slime its sort of slimy texture. And there's another kind of cell that produces the mucus component, and those cells rupture when the slime gland contracts, and there's billions and billions of these little packets of mucus. Those swell up and do something really interesting that we don't fully understand. They interact with the threads, they interact with the seawater, and the net result is this material that, as I said, is really good at clogging the gills of predators.
Wow. And from observation, it seems to be almost reflexive. So if you touch a hagfish or pinch it at one point, only those glands seem to fire?
Yes. So for a long time, we didn't realize that. So when you catch hagfish on a boat, and you've experienced this, Tom, you know, the slime is coming out everywhere.
Yeah, the whole thing's angry.
You can just see this milky stuff pouring out of the slime glands. And it wasn't until we filmed hagfish in captivity under semi-realistic conditions and sort of pretended like we were biting them that we realized that, you know, it's only in the vicinity of where they're getting bitten that they release the slime. So that's interesting. And it also, you know, it obviously makes sense. The slime is probably a pretty big energy investment for the hagfish. So it doesn't make sense for the whole animal to be shooting slime out in every direction.
And it's so effective. I didn't know that about the mucus component, that there isn't sort of a bladder or a reservoir of it. The cells themselves are sacrificed. Mm-hmm. They can produce a lot and it's spectacular, but it's got to take quite a long time to recover, isn't it? The cells have got to be regrown rather than just producing more mucus.
Yeah, exactly. So I had a PhD student who looked into this question of slime gland regeneration. So this was Sarah Shorno's work at the University of Guelph. And the answer she came up with is that it basically takes a month for them to refill a slime gland that has been emptied. So again, another reason not to shoot them all off at once, because, you know, a hagfish without slime would be very vulnerable.
And I've seen it seems incredibly effective as a defense, like you say, especially for anything with gills. Do we think if a shark gets a good dose, is that shark probably going to die? It's incredibly difficult to get the slime off. From personal experience, I wouldn't want to be breathing it.
Yeah, we don't know the answer to that. And I haven't done the experiment. I'm not looking forward to the animal care protocol that would have to be written to do that experiment. But, you know, you've probably seen the videos from the group at Te Papa, actually, Vincent and colleagues.
Yes, yeah. The little dogfish having a chomp.
You know, these sharks coming in, biting hard on a hagfish, and then just swimming away with a mouthful of slime kind of streaming out of its gills. And yeah, the obvious question is, what happens to that shark? We don't know, because, you know, in all these videos, the predator swims away and we don't see it anymore. But I can tell you a little bit about what we know from our lab experiments working with the slime. So, you know, we can collect exudate out of slime glands from anesthetized hagfishes, and we can work with the slime and we can sort of measure its properties and that sort of thing. And, you know, we've confirmed that the slime is really amazing at clogging. And we've tried to compare it to other materials that you might think would also be good at clogging. So like really high molecular weight polymers, food thickeners like xanthan gum. And the slime is more than two orders of magnitude, more than 100 times better than all the materials we tried in terms of how good it is at slowing the flow of water across a mesh. So how does that relate to your question of, you know, does the shark survive? So in those experiments, we were really interested in understanding how the mucus was contributing and how the threads, those really fine fibers, were contributing. And I had always assumed that the fibers were really important for the clogging function. And so we did an experiment where we physically separated the mucus and the threads and measured the clogging performance separately. And the amazing thing we found was that the mucus alone is pretty much as good as the whole slime with the fibers in it.
Wow.
So it's really the mucus that's doing the clogging. So that led to another interesting question, which is, you know, what the heck are the fibers even doing there? They're clearly really complicated to make. The cells that make them are just one of the most interesting cells you can imagine. They spin this ball of yarn in their cytoplasm that is just an incredible structure. Clearly, selection is, you know, invented these things and perfected them over millions of years for a reason.
Yeah.
And so our current understanding is that the fibers are there to keep the slime on the gills. So we did another experiment where we tried to wash the slime away. And this relates to your question of, you know, what happens to the shark? Is the slime there forever or can they flush it away? So we tried sort of chasing the slime with just seawater And we just kept doing that and measuring the drain rate. And what we found is that if you leave out the fibers, you know, the first go of the mucus alone is really good at slowing the flow. But if you flush it again, you pretty much reduce the clogging effect to almost nothing. So in other words, it's really easy to sort of wash it away. If you have the fibers in there, on the other hand, it's really hard to wash the fibers or wash the mucus away. So you can flush it with about 20 volumes more of seawater and the performance stays pretty similar. So again, your question of how long does the slime remain on there? Does the shark suffocate? Can it get it off? We don't know exactly, but
it doesn't look good.
It doesn't look good, but I'll say one more complication, which is that we were adding water from the top of our clogging assay, whereas a shark has the ability to back flush. Mm-hmm. So we weren't back flushing. So, you know, maybe a shark, if it really forcefully back flushes, might be able to recover enough gill function to squeeze through.
Which seems to be the first response, like that classic video that the team took here, it immediately coughs and coughs out this big bolus of slime.
Yeah. So that video, when we saw that, so that came out in 2011, and we had published a paper in 2006 where we argued that, you know, the prime function of slime was to clog gills. We had never seen it in the wild. We had never seen it in the lab. And we did some crazy experiments where we sort of added slime to isolated fish heads that we got from a fish market and, you know, just tried to get at that question that way. So to see those videos from the group in New Zealand was just amazing for us. And I show that video every time I give a talk. I show that video of that kite fin shark coming in and biting a hagfish and swimming away in horror.
A big mistake. Obviously, it's gonna really train the predators to avoid them. It's quite a big punishment if you get that wrong. Is there a noxious element? Because both fishers and in our own traps, we've seen a deterrent effect. We've seen sort of eels coming in after hagfish have been feeding and then immediately backing out. Mm. And I don't know if it's threads in the water and they're responding to that, or if there's a almost noxious, because I feel like I've almost seen them claim dibs on a meal by sliming it without any sort of predator interaction, just to sort of keep everyone else away from this food fall they found.
Yeah, that is something that we've seen several times now as well, that, you know, hagfish feeding around a carcass or, you know, some bait that you put on the bottom, they very often will slime, even though nothing is biting them. And the result is you can end up with quite a bit of slime sort of accumulating around that food. And I do think that has a deterrent effect on other scavengers and predators.
Are they vulnerable at all themselves to this defense? If I've seen too many in too small a container, I think I've seen them sort of choke themselves.
Yeah, so I get this question a lot because people know that hagfish have gills and the slime is really good at clogging gills. So what's going on there? So the reason the slime works so well against jawed fishes is because of the way the mouth is set up in relation to the gills. Let's say you're getting swallowed by a shark, right? As you're going down into the mouth, you're going past the gills. They're right there, right? And for the hagfish, that's sort of their opportunity, right? So they, in the process of being eaten, they slime the gills, and that's their strategy. Hagfish gills are not in the mouth, and so they're not vulnerable in that way. They're sort of, as we said before, they've got this nostril on the front of their head. It leads via these pipes down to their gill pouches, which are sort of neatly tucked away. And so it'd be really difficult for their slime to sort of slime their own gills. And your second question about, you know, can they suffocate themselves? I think that's true. If you have hagfish in a bucket and they're stressed out and they turn all of the water in the bucket to slime, which they're very capable of doing, if there's enough of them, yeah, eventually they will suffocate because they can't breathe slime. And another amazing thing that hagfishes do that many of your listeners will know about is knot tying. And they do this for various reasons, but one of the reasons is if they do happen to get caught in their own slime, which is pretty rare under kind of natural conditions, but certainly in a bucket, if they have nowhere to go, they might end up inside a a big massive slime. But if that happens, what they do is they tie their body in a knot and then they pass their body through that knot. And that has the effect of essentially wiping the slime off of their body.
And they can use that knot as an anchor as well, don't they? They do it for a few different reasons, but that almost gives them leverage. They can push off from a burrow or from a carcass using that.
Yeah, exactly. You might have seen videos of hagfish feeding maybe on a whale carcass, and they'll tie their body in a knot. They'll sort of brace their head up against the carcass with a sort of loop of that overhand knot, and then, you know, use that to more forcefully tear chunks away from the carcass.
They are amazing.
Yeah, it's clever.
So how unique and useful this slime is, there's been a few human applications, hasn't there?
Okay, so when I did my PhD, I was in a biomaterials lab where most of the research going on around me was on spider silk. And there was a lot of interest at the time about spider silk as a material and biomimetic efforts to make synthetic spider silk. Right around that time, I was doing mechanical testing on these very fine fibers from hagfish slime. And one of the things that came out of that work was the realization that the material properties of these hagfish fibers are actually quite good and not as amazing as spider silk, but pretty close. And so there's been quite a bit of interest in sort of doing a similar thing that was already going on with spider silk, but with hagfish fibers. And that work continues. I sort of dabbled in it for a while with my PhD supervisor, John Goslein, but there's a group at Utah State who's very actively pursuing this line of research with funding from the Navy. They're basically using microbial vectors to make large quantities of the proteins that make up hagfish fibers.
The material properties are so interesting. Yeah, we like a bit of biologically inspired design. We had a couple of questions from some of the listeners. So one of them noticed that on the Schmidt Oceans live streams, they were surprised by the color variation in hagfish. We associate them a pale or slightly gray, but there's quite beautiful oranges and pinky looking ones. And then here in New Zealand, we have quite a beautiful mottled one. What actually is the variation? Because it's really quite striking. They're quite pretty, some of them.
Yeah. If you had to give a sort of average hagfish color, it's not that exciting. So most of them are brownish, grayish, but there are some really interesting exceptions. I mentioned the ghost hagfish, which is an albino hagfish. So yeah, so there's, you know, there's this white one. There's, as you mentioned, there's reddish orange ones. The interesting thing about those is they all belong to the same genus, Rubicundus. And there's only four of them described right now. And they all have a sort of unique tubular nose. They're all orangish red. And weirdly, they're found very far apart from each other. There's one in Galapagos. There's one in Taiwan. Actually, you guys have one in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. And then there's one off the Carolinas in the Atlantic. Yeah, we don't understand anything about why the color variation exists. A lot of these animals occur well below any sort of natural light reaching them. So who knows what's driving these different colors.
Yeah. Everything else around them seems to be going for the red or the black in order to disappear. But there's still some variation in the hagfish.
Yeah.
You touched upon genetics there, and there was there's been a full genome published quite recently, and even genetically they're oddballs. Is it true that there's sort of mini chromosomes and that they lose them throughout their development? The adults don't have the full suite?
Yeah.
I didn't fully understand it, actually. It was so weird. I couldn't quite get my head around it.
Yeah, no, this is fascinating. So, you know, it might seem quite shocking to people that we just now have the first hagfish genome published. And the reason is that they do this thing called chromosome elimination, which is very rare. You know, one of the things that we're taught in intro biology is that every cell in our body has the same genome. And, you know, isn't that interesting? How is a heart cell so different from a liver cell, even though they have the same genome? But it turns out that's not true in hagfish. They will just eliminate entire chromosomes from certain tissues. And so if you're hoping to sequence a hagfish genome and you take a muscle sample, you're going to miss a whole bunch of chromosomes. So you need gonads to do it, to have all the chromosomes represented.
It's crazy. It goes totally against, like you say, everything we're taught. That is really, really strange.
But, you know, in many ways, it kind of makes sense, right? Like, I find the other situation sort of surprising. Like,
we waste a lot of energy transcribing a load of nonsense.
Exactly. So it's kind of smart, I think.
Is it tissue differentiation or is it ontogenetic? Is it are there genes related to the juveniles that they then drop? Or is it once I've decided to become muscle tissue, I'm just going to carry muscle information?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know.
Yeah, I needed to try and get my head around that paper because it was just immediately exciting and makes sense for something that wants to save energy.
It's, you know, it's just like yet another data point in the adage that, you know, hagfish are just weird in every way. Like, no matter what aspect of their biology you're looking at, expect to be surprised. And that just happens over and over again. I don't know why they're so weird, but they are.
I think that reaches the sort of end of my main questions, but is there any misconception, anything you want to get out there to set the record straight?
I think one of the things that people have in their head about hagfish is that they are disgusting. Like, literally, if you could peer into people's heads, the word disgusting would be linked to the word hagfish. And there's some justification for that. Usually when you're fishing hagfish or other animals and you get hagfish, it's not very pleasant when you bring them up. They're sliming like crazy. They're voiding their guts, which is mixing with the slime. And oftentimes what they've been eating is not very pleasant and smelly. And it can be pretty disgusting. But having observed hagfish in their natural habitats and having them in the lab and interacting with them on a daily basis, you know, they are really amazing creatures. And they're not disgusting most of the time under sort of normal conditions.
We don't see them at their best.
Yeah, we see them at their absolute worst. And, you know, when they're swimming around the tank or they're burrowing, they're like really neat, elegant creatures. And I might have a bit of Stockholm syndrome, but, you know, I think they're almost cute now.
That's so true to so many deep sea critters, though. You know, a lot of the horror at deep sea fish is explosive decompression and damage from a net. And it's not even how they view each other. They view each other as alluring smells and incredible light shows and things like that. On their own terms, they're incredible.
Exactly. Actually, there is one misconception that's out there. So if you go on FishBase and you look for information about a given hagfish species, you know, there'll be a line about reproduction and somebody clearly just sort of copied and pasted this into every hagfish species. But it basically says that hagfish are hermaphrodites. And that is just absolutely not true. There are some papers describing a handful of hermaphroditic hagfish individuals, but it is definitely not true that entire species are hermaphroditic. They definitely have separate male and female sexes.
There's a few like that have been copy-pasted to a few too many.
And we haven't talked about hagfish reproduction at all.
We haven't, and I know nothing about it.
But really, there isn't much known about it. And I think it's because most of the reproduction happens in burrows, and so nobody's ever seen it because it's hidden away.
Is it direct development? Are they miniature adults?
Yes. Yeah, they just pop out as little miniature hagfish. I don't know if you've ever seen hagfish eggs.
No.
Hagfish eggs are quite large. So a gravid hagfish female will have, you know, like 20 to 30 eggs total. And so they're big. They're, you know, a centimeter, 2 centimeters long. And they have these little filamentous structures sprouting off of their two poles that are kind of attachment structures. And we're doing some work on those now, sort of looking at the biomechanics of attachment of hagfish eggs. But yeah, so it's direct development, very yolky. So they're like these bright yellow eggs.
Loads of energy to get started.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's pretty much most of what we know about hagfish reproduction.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. I knew this was an area I only knew the tip of an iceberg, and it just got weirder and weirder. And I don't think I've seen the bottom. It's just carrying on below me.
Yeah. Welcome to my world.
Yeah. There's still so much to do.
That's right. Okay. Well, this was super fun.
After speaking with Doug, we got an update, actually, because we were talking about the pharyngeocutaneous duct. So they have these gill pouches, they have these little holes where the water leaves the body, but then on one side, usually one of them is a little bit bigger, and it seems to be connected directly to the pharynx, directly to the throat, without
going via the gills. And Doug just updated us that a lot of the old hagfish books used to say that this was a way of ejecting particles that were too big for the gills, so that would have clogged the gills. And that was sort of the general consensus. But he personally thinks that doesn't make much sense, because that is actually behind all the gills. So if it was going to clog them, it would have already clogged them. And fish can kind of cough and reverse the flow to sort of dislodge things. But he reckons it's probably more to do with squeezing the food to remove any excess water before they swallow it and digest it. Because if you swallow lots of water, you dilute your stomach acid and enzymes, and digestion isn't so effective. And because of the way they sort of feed and rasp and tear at flesh, it actually makes sense for them to wring it out like a sponge before they swallow it, so they're not taking on loads of water. So yeah, nice little update. Thanks for writing back in, Doug, and closing that loop. Because yeah, there's weird anatomy on these things, as you will have heard.
Coffee's ready!
So we've just had a lovely chat with Douglas Fudge, king of the hagfish.
Yes.
He wouldn't mind being called that.
No, I'm a bit of a fanboy.
You are, and then, yeah, that was a bit that we'll be missing from the episode, is that we didn't let him go for at least another hour, because yeah. I couldn't keep you out the room.
No, but I don't think he was sort of itching to get away either.
No, I think he was keen to talk
hagfish. He wasn't looking at his watch at any time.
I'm not
uncomfortable or shifting a lot in his seat.
So there are two things that came up in that interview. One was that key piece of footage from Vincent Sinson and the team work with Brovs, which was the first, there's been one since, but the first predator-prey interaction with a shark biting a hagfish.
Shark, and then a number of other teleosts and sharks as well, having a half-hearted go and failing dismally. But that, the shark one was really cool.
Yeah, that's like one of the first hits on YouTube, isn't it? That piece of footage.
Yeah.
So I know that was instrumental. And hearing Douglas talk about it as well, of like how much that informed what he was looking at and his understanding of the predator-prey interaction.
All we had up until then was hypothesis.
Yeah.
And this was actually proved positive.
And then the other one that came up was the Goliath, which is something I know you're very proud of, because 10 years ago when I was just a visitor, that was one of your proudest beasts in a tank.
Yeah. Yes, we show it to some of our Asian visitors, and they just sort of go, oh! They can't believe that Myxonids get that big. I know they get longer. I know there are some species that are longer. I think the one that was taken in deep water off the Galapagos and described by John McCosker gets a lot bigger, a lot longer than that.
Just doesn't have the mass.
Solid.
Yeah.
Chunky, 6-point-something kg.
Good hefty hagfish.
Yeah. I must admit, I was a latecomer to hagfish.
They won the whole team over, didn't they?
They did, yeah.
Over as well.
Yeah, I'd come to it before then, I think mostly through Michael Mancaroni. And he sort of seduced me with that Goliath paper, and then I started to get more interested in it. And then the very first expedition that the team mounted just got so many hagfish, including more Goliath species. And initially there was a bit of resistance to it, and who wants to work on hagfish, yuck. But the more you study them, the more you sort of think, damn, these things are fascinating.
Yeah.
They really are. I mean, first impressions are, this is Frankenstein's sausage that's come to life sort of thing. You know, it's alive. But then you realise, well, you know, it's a study in reduction.
Well, that's it. Even beyond hagfish, they inform so much about the origin of fishes, what's important, what you can get by on without. And then I find it really interesting that they've regressed, in fact, though. So they were the proto-fish, they were the first beginnings of everything. Everything else radiated and became more advanced. And they have found their niche by actually becoming more primitive. I know that's a loaded term, but they, you know, they've lost their eyes and things like that.
And they retain sort of the characters that they had right back at the start. It wasn't as though they sort of had them and then dumped them. It was put onto this paper of a Myxonid and a lamprey fossil from China, and very, very fine sedimentary rock. And you can see the gill pouches and you can see the slime pores. And this is the only chordate that's retained that out of that massive explosion in the Cambrian, where let's just experiment. And instead of saying, hey, that really worked well, we'll continue with that, they've kept it. All the other chordates have gone off and, no, we'll develop jaws and fins.
All these fancy things.
Yeah, we'll get fancy. And the chordates sort of took off. But the Myxonids basically sort of said, we're going to stick with what works. And certainly the slime pores and the thread cells work.
I wonder if those have really been sites of evolution. Once you end up with more teleost predators, whether actually, even though the slime pores were there,
if you were going to go back and look at the slime and the tangling threads, if in the primitive ones, you know, that's where evolution has taken hold. Once they had more higher vertebrate predators, and it's all about flogging gills.
A higher functioning brain, problem solving, better fins, better jaws, better decision making, able to swim faster, swim deeper, go into fresh water, whatever. Mm. Yeah, whether that negated the need to actually go through all that palaver of making mucus granules, making thread granules, because hagfish, the myxinids, really are stuck in the marine environment. I'm not aware of any fossils that are associated with the freshwater environment.
Just their buddies they always get grouped along with.
The lampreys.
The lampreys, yeah.
Yeah, and they come and go. And some of them are even permanently landlocked, some species. Yes, it'd be very interesting to see whether or not there are sort of groups within and how monophyletic are some of these genera. I mean, Epaptris eos, the pink hagfish, is now rubicundus. And that's now a cluster of something like three species, all found deep water, associated with bryozoan, deep water coral beds and things like that.
I prefer the new name. It's easier to remember.
Rubicundus.
Because the colour.
Yes, I know.
It's a,
yes.
I need all the help I can get with Latin names.
But naming it after the goddess of morning blush, which is about as good as it gets for a hagfish, isn't it?
That's pretty complimentary.
It is. It's pretty lovely. New Zealand's fauna going from three species to nine. That's quite something. We're one of the hot spots in terms of numbers of species. And that's what came out of this deep pot work and funding that had Vincent and co. going from the Kermadec down to the Auckland Islands, looking from a couple of hundred metres down to 1,200 metres. Vincent did this maths. He said, flayed end to end, we measured something like 250 metres, linear metres of hagfish. I counted something like 16,000 slime pores.
This sounds like sausage fest. This sounds like our competitive sausage eating.
It really was. But when you actually look at hagfishes, how they're preserved, they really are not treated well in museum collections. People just sort of go, hagfish, toss it into formalin. So it pickles in a kind of, looking like a Brockverse sausage, you know, all wrinkly and the slime pickles on it. And you try and count slime pores on something that's sort of fixed like that, and you're trying to open out the wrinkles. Is there a slime pore in there? Open there.
And it's someone else's specimen. So you don't want to really be rough.
You don't really want to crank it. Whereas we spent days and days and days with little paring knives using the back of them to scrape the slime off the outside and then put your finger down the throat.
Yeah, this is the bit I wanted to get onto. Tell us about brushing their teeth.
So you put your finger down their throat, you hook your finger into those teeth and you pull it out the whole tongue, and then you get with an old toothbrush and you get the slime off the teeth, you get the slime out of the that whole pharyngeal region so that the teeth are nice and clean. Now, we wondered whether or not they were sufficiently dense that we could perhaps x-ray them so you didn't have to cut them open on specimens that have been preserved. But no matter how we bait them, we couldn't see them. So what we were doing was we're pulling out the tooth pads, we're giving them a good scrub, and then we're recording the number of multicusps and unicusps and all those. And then, of course, obviously the whole thing goes poof back inside the moment you let it go. But we've laid out our hagfish. They're pickled nice and straight. They're pickled clean.
The cleanest, straightest hagfish
in the world. And we've now got two 500-litre tanks dedicated to and holding nothing but myxinidae.
And I had to put that protocol into an email to other people and hope that they take me seriously.
It is. I mean, it is well worth
the toothbrush.
Effort. Yeah.
And they were on a boat, so they had to sacrifice somebody's toothbrush.
Yeah. It's just so much worth it at the other end.
Right. Cheers.
Cheers.
Till the next one.
Till the next one, bro.
And that concludes this episode of the Deep Sea Podcast. I don't know how we talk to end it now.
How do we end these things? How have we ever ended these things?
Yeah, how do we stop? Why are we so rusty? I know it's been a weird few months because we've been so busy. This feels weird. I feel out of sync.
Oh, it is quite weird because I'm also rolling around quite a lot because I'm top of the ship at the moment. Can't concentrate. So everything's just moving.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I can't remember. I can't remember anything about this Deep Sea Podcast any years.
Well, don't put it on me. It's ours. It's our baby.
Nah, this is your fault. It's totally your fault. I don't know, we're up to what, episode 45?
45,
now.
Yeah.
So we've done this 45 times.
Yeah, and still mess it up.
How do we end it?
Georgia, fix this
Play
for
some
us.
Some music or something.
Fix this. Oh yeah, there's music at the end. Do the music.
Bye. We'll be right back.
If you would like to advertise with the Deep Sea Podcast, feel free to get in touch. Our audience is primarily young people with an interest in science, often undergraduates or people considering a degree in marine science, but it also includes established scientists. Feel free to get in touch if you're interested in reaching these groups.
There's supposed to be a little funny bit at the end as well, but I think we stopped doing that recently because no one's got anything funny to say.
I think this might be it. I think we might be within it right now.
But if we're in the funny bit right now, the funny bit is normally about, what, 10 seconds, 20 seconds? How long can we push the funny bit at the end before people start getting annoyed and just want to fall asleep?
Well, it's that meta humor, isn't it? Where you tell a bad joke and then you keep going until it comes around to funny again? Yeah.
All right. So we're in the funny bit now then, do you think?
Well.
What does it feel like to you?
Tingly. Yeah.
Not fizzy.
Yeah, it's on the surface, though. It's like lots of static electricity in the air. That's how I can tell.
I find that being in the funny bit at the end feels like I'm drowning in intense silence.
It's the curse of the medium because it's one way. I'm sure everyone is like clapping and laughing and getting distracted while they're driving.
Yeah, that'll be it. Driving around, and when are these guys going to shut up? You know, I mean, to be fair, you can switch us off at any point. No one's making you listen to this, but
they might not have hands free. They might not be able to reach it.
Because it's the little bit at the end, it doesn't have anything after it. It feels like I'm free falling. It's not like we've got music coming up or your little skit about whatever the company does.
There's not an end.
Yeah, there's no bookends to this bit. So it's just free falling. It's just like spiraling aimlessly through three-dimensional darkness and silence.